Shrink Wrap Radio number 473, Assessing Psychosis with Dr. James Klager.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is Dr. Jim Klager, co-author, along with Dr. Ali Khadivi, of the 2015 book, Assessing Psychosis, A Clinician's Guide. For more information about Dr. Jim Klager, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Jim Klager, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dave. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure for me. It's good to have this opportunity to speak with you, and particularly to speak to you about your book on Assessing Psychosis, A Clinician's Guide, because I haven't been in a position where I've needed to do that kind of assessment in a long, long time. So this is going to be very educational for me, and I'm sure for members of my audience, particularly those who are currently clinicians or clinicians-to-be. You and your co-author, Ali Khadivi, are both clinicians, and that's really shaped the orientation of your book, which is designed to help professionals in the trenches to make differential diagnoses. So why don't we start with you describing the clinical environments in which you two are operating, because you're in different environments, I gather, and because that sort of sets up the stage for your book.
Sure. We are in different environments, practicing in different states. I approach the subject matter as a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst who works in an outpatient setting. I have a practice which involves consultations with children, adolescents, and adults who present with a range of difficulties, psychiatric and psychological, social kinds of problems, sometimes school-related difficulties. Oftentimes, questions arise around whether or not some of the individual's difficulties might be understood as manifestations of underlying psychosis or emerging psychosis. My colleague and friend, Ali Khadivi, has a very different practice setting. He is a staff psychologist, senior psychologist at a major medical center and teaching hospital in New York, and occupies about half of his time teaching and supervising psychology interns and psychiatry residents in emergency mental health rotations that involve seeing people who are brought in from the street in various kinds of acute crises in the emergency department, and then making determinations about diagnosis and disposition, often involving whether or not to hospitalize somebody. So he sees a lot of acute individuals presenting with different kinds of psychotic symptoms. Dr. Khadivi also has a forensic psychology practice where he approaches this subject matter from a kind of a medical legal perspective, looking at questions of the insanity defense and diminished capacity. So he also has a unique angle from the legal.
Well, what a great collaboration, because it adds a great depth to your book that you two operate in such different environments and circumstances. You mentioned he's in New York and that you're in different states. Where are you?
I'm in Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay. And how did you two get to know each other? Did you go to graduate school together or what?
Actually, I became aware of him, and I believe he of me, in the 1990s, the late 90s, early 2000s. Both of us have a shared interest as clinical psychologists in psychological assessment. We both had a keen interest in understanding psychosis. I trained at the Menninger Clinic and taught and worked there in the 80s and 90s and developed an interest in understanding psychosis, thought disorder in particular. In the late 90s, I wrote a book on using the Rorschach to assess disordered thinking.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's when I became aware of Ali Khadidi, who had done some work in this area.
Okay.
And I approached him around 2010, 2011, after having heard him give a talk, and suggested that we do some collaborative work. And that's when we began doing some workshops on utilizing the clinical interview and the Rorschach to understand psychotic experience and symptoms. And from there, we came upon the idea of broadening the focus a bit beyond testing, per se, and writing a book.
Yeah. So what led you and Dr. Khadidi to write a book about psychosis, given that there must be a ton of other books out there on that topic?
Well, there certainly are. There have been many fine books written. I really, what defined our focus and drove our interest was the passion that we shared for assessment and wanting to really write a book that would focus on understanding the confusing, sometimes contradictory nature of psychosis, trying to explain things in a clear way, making complex issues clear but not oversimplifying them, and then really keeping the focus on understanding through different assessment procedures.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say you have a passion for assessment, and many people look at diagnosis, which is what assessment is about, as pinning labels on people that burden them with a stigma throughout their lives. What's your take on that, and why is assessment important to you as clinicians, and it's, to the extent that it's your passion?
Sure. Well, anything that stigmatizes people is a bad thing in my view. And certainly diagnosis has stigmatized people, certainly misdiagnosis. I think diagnosis is important in any field because, quite simply, before you intervene and try to do something about a problem, it behooves a practitioner to understand what he or she is trying to address or change. So before any kind of treatment is undertaken, it's important to understand a person, their strengths and weaknesses, their capacities, their areas of vulnerability. But, I think the term itself, diagnosis, is a bit misleading because if we only look at it in the traditional medical sense, that pigeonholes us a bit, because if we think of medical diagnoses in terms of naming a condition or problem, that is where we can get into the trap of labeling.
That's a very interesting point that you're making, a distinction between diagnosis, which comes up with sort of a fixed label, if you will, and assessment, which it sounds like is more of a dynamic process.
I think so. I would say that I don't want to devalue or demonize the classical term of diagnosis. In fact, I make a distinction of diagnosis with a capital D versus diagnosis with a lowercase d. the traditional classical diagnosis is an effective way of communicating a general understanding about someone's problems. But I always think of diagnosis in that respect as kind of a place to start.
Okay.
It's a little bit, and this sounds perhaps a bit quaint, but it's a little bit like looking on a map and finding a neighborhood. And the neighborhood is like the diagnosis with a capital D, and it kind of identifies where someone lives, what part of town, what the conditions of that particular sector of the city might be. But within that neighborhood, there are many different houses that have different styles. Some are new, some are old, some are one story, some are two.
Yeah.
So there's a great deal of variability, and that's where the lowercase diagnosis concept comes in. And that has to do with understanding a person's experiences, her level of functioning, how she thinks, manages, and tolerates affect, experiences of self and others, how her functioning might shift across different kinds of conditions. So that kind of diagnosis really has to do with more of understanding a person and experience, more experience in your ways.
Yeah, good. I really like that metaphor. I think it's a good metaphor. So before we go any further, let's have you define psychosis.
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons that we wrote the book, or one of the reasons I was interested in getting into this, is that it is such a term that is a part of our lexicon that is easily misunderstood, and I think there are some general ways of talking about it, but probably lots of different ideas as well. I think that the first way to define psychosis is to talk about it as a major class of severe psychiatric disorders that are grouped together in different diagnostic systems like the ICD-9, the soon-to-come-out ICD-10, the DSM systems. Psychotic disorders, if you will, are usually thought of as psychiatric emergencies that require immediate intervention. And treatment typically includes different forms of therapies, medication, support, education, often a stabilizing environment. Another way to think about or define psychosis is in terms of describing the mental and behavioral functioning of the individual. In other words, what he says and what he does, and in some cases doesn't do.
Yeah, along those lines, you list six phenomena as hallmarks of psychosis, and perhaps you could take us through the six.
Sure. I think that typically the hallmark symptoms include things like delusions and hallucinations, disordered thinking or disorganized speech, bizarre behavior, what's referred to as negative symptoms, increasingly attention is paid to cognitive impairment, impairment in functions like attention, working memory, other kinds of executive functions. And then there's the importance of insight that's really not considered a symptom of psychosis, but it's kind of a linchpin in understanding what separates psychotic from non-psychotic experience. It's a very critically important concept.
Yeah, you mentioned negative signs and symptoms, and that when I encountered that in the book, it wasn't really clear what you're referring to. You do go on and explain
sure.
it later, but
sure.
What are you getting at there?
Originally, when people began to think about the different dimensions of, well, let me take a step back.
Okay.
For much of the century, psychosis was really thought of in terms of schizophrenia. People talked about paranoia, people talked about manic depressive psychosis and schizophrenia. But in this country, the United States, schizophrenia was the predominant form of psychosis, and really all thoughts about psychosis really were kind of synonymous with schizophrenia. And so when people began to think about the different dimensions of schizophrenia, one of the ways that they distinguished broad dimensions of symptoms was in terms of those that were positive symptoms and those that were negative symptoms. And this comes from some 19th century thinking of a British neurologist, the difference between negative and positive symptoms. Positive symptoms really include those florid features that are kind of hallmark signs of psychosis. Hallucinations, delusions, disorganized speech, bizarre behavior, things that are noticeable that immediately get your attention. Negative symptoms, on the other hand, really are the absence of functions. And they can be described in terms of flatness of affect, loss of interest, motivation, pleasure, impoverished speech, lack of speech, lack of energy. So negative symptoms are the absence of things that we would expect to be present in normal, healthy functioning.
Okay, that's very helpful. That really makes it clear. Now, in a subsequent chapter, you go into more depth on some of the positive signs that you were discussing. Let's take a look at a couple of those. Hallucinations, for example. Maybe you can expand a bit on hallucinations.
Well, hallucinations, simply defined, would be perceptual experience, kind of across different perceptual modalities, for which there's no actual sensory input, so that an individual can hear voices when there is no one actually speaking. People can see visions, see objects, people, animals, when there is nothing there to be seen. Hallucinations can also occur in other sensory modalities. Tactile hallucinations would include the experience that one is being touched when, in fact, that's not occurring. Olfactory hallucinations and gustatory hallucinations, tastes and smells for which there's no sensory input.
A rule of thumb that I was exposed to some time back, and I'm wondering if this, in fact, is true or not, is that schizophrenics will hear voices, will have audio hallucinations, but that people with visual hallucinations, it's more suggestive of an organic neurological problem. Does that hold or not?
There's some truth to that. There's probably not as much of a kind of binary distinction as there once was, because many people who have schizophrenia and have hallucinatory experiences will report visual hallucinations.
Okay.
But you're right. Auditory hallucinations are most common in psychosis. Now, when you do get visual hallucinations, and even more so, olfactory hallucinations, it is useful to think about other kinds of medical causes. Visual hallucinations might alert you to a drug-induced state, and olfactory hallucinations clearly can be associated with seizure activity.
Uh-huh.
So there is some distinction in terms of the type of hallucination And it's kind of switching gears. People often mistake illusions for hallucinations. Illusions are typically when there is some sort of sensory input and one misinterprets it. For example, in a dark room, seeing a shadow on the wall from an object in the room and becoming panicky because you interpret that as a stranger who's gotten into the room.
Right. Fairly frequently, I'll be walking along and there'll be a stick in the road, and that can look like a snake, you know, for a little bit.
Yeah, that would be an illusion. That's different from a hallucination.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really the broad definition of hallucinatory experience. It is important to note that hallucinations really do not are not by themselves pathognomonic psychosis. It's something that I think can be easily misunderstood. If an individual is hallucinating, he must be psychotic.
That's an important point, because my grandmother, who was a fundamentalist evangelist, said that that Jesus appeared to her on two different occasions. So, you know, either Jesus appeared to her or it was some kind of a hallucinatory experience, but she was not psychotic.
Yeah, and I think that not to stray too far from the discussion on hallucinations, that all of these symptoms really do occur along a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the most interesting things about psychotic phenomenon. We're not talking about discrete binary events. We're talking about experience that really extends from the non-clinical, kind of normal, quote-unquote, a sector of the population all the way to those who are clinically impaired or psychotically impaired. So,
you know, that's an interesting point. And in one of your chapters is titled Diagnostic Categories or Dimensions. And so it seemed like that was the kind of issue you were raising. I recently interviewed another diagnostician who thinks of people as differing along a number of continua rather than falling into discrete categories. And it sounds like you're talking about something quite similar.
Yeah, I think in all clinical diagnostic work now, there's movement away from categorical thinking to continuums and dimensions.
Interesting.
And that's been very clear in the personality assessment, personality disorder field, and it's increasingly the case in psychosis research. Going back 100 years, it was established that there were two or three distinct categories of psychotic illness. Dementia praecox, which was later called schizophrenia, manic depressive psychosis, and paranoia, and they were each thought to have a very different onset course, some overlap in symptoms, but very, very distinct categories. And this was a belief that really held sway through the 20th century, and only in the last maybe 30 years or so have researchers determined that this is not the best and most valid way to understand people, not in terms of separate categories, but more in terms of dimensions of experience or symptom dimensions that occur across these different diagnostic groupings, so that none of these symptoms immediately leads to the conclusion that somebody has this particular kind of illness. It used to be thought, for example, that thought disorder was pathognomonic of schizophrenia, or certain kinds of bizarre delusions were immediately determinant of schizophrenia That's not the case.
You know, we clinicians use terms like thought disorder, but it might be that a lot of my listeners might not know exactly what you're referring to. Can you give us some examples of thought disorder?
Well, I think the best way to approach this, and please cut me off if I go on too long, because this is probably the area that I'm most interested in.
Trying to
tease out the meaning of what has been a very slippery and elusive term.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to change over time.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know, originally, I think people thought about thought disorder as a hallmark feature of schizophrenia, and what people were talking about was problems in verbal communication, where ideas would be presented in a discontinuous way. You've heard of the term looseness of associations, which was a term constructed by Eugene Bleuler back in the 19th century to describe the disconnection between ideas as a person would talk about them. Thought disorder was described in terms of verbal characteristics, this speech that's distractible, speech that is tangential, that is loosely connected, and at worst can be incoherent, where terms can be made up, essentially any sort of communicative value is lost. So that's kind of the traditional definition of what came to be called a formal thought disorder, but it really is focused mainly on the way a person is speaking. What's missed in this definition is what goes on inside somebody's mind in terms of how they form concepts, how they reason, how they use logic. And that, to me, has been kind of an overlooked area in definitions of thought disorder. People have focused more exclusively on disorganized speech. In fact, the DSM-5 has kind of done away with the term. Actually, the DSM-4 did away with the term thought disorder and talked about disorganized thinking. Now the DSM-5 talks about disorganized speech. So thinking, reasoning, concept formation, logic is sort of diminished in terms of focus.
To me, that's an interesting distinction between speech and thinking. I mean, how can we know what's going on inside the person's head except for what they tell us?
You know, Dave, that is probably a central point of debate that's existed for a long time and still exists between mental health folks like psychologists and psychiatrists who are clinicians and do research in this area, on the one hand, versus linguists and psycholinguists and speech and language people who really do study psychosis and disordered speech and language. And they make the point you just did, which is, you know, all we have is speech. And it's a mistake to try to make inferences about, you know, the invisible qualities of thinking.
Yeah, of course, now with the neuropsychological, with the imaging tools, we may get closer to that.
Right, right. So here's just to go on a bit more what Ali Khadidi and I tried to do in terms of teasing this out a little bit is to broaden the definition and to think of thought disorder. And by the way, people have argued for a long time whether that's a good term. They've come up with other terms. Like I said, disorganized speech, language disorder, communication disorder. But I use the term thought disorder because it's communicative. People know, are familiar with the term. Have an idea about generally what it means. But we think of it in terms of problems in a number of dimensions. The first is problems in how you face it, which has to do with that first category, which is disorganized speech. Somebody is talking in a way that is loose. It might be distractible. It might be halting. It might be pressured. It might be too rapid. It might be incoherent. But that's, again, a problem in what in a problem in how somebody is saying something. There's a second dimension, and that's the problem in what somebody's thinking, what they think, the content of their thoughts, bizarre ideas, strange and odd beliefs, which could reach the level of a delusion. A third category is where those beliefs come from, how the person thinks about them, how they reason, how they use logic, how they form concepts. A fourth dimension has to do with when somebody says something and to whom they say it. Which brings in the whole social cognitive thing, issue of timing, issue of do you know that it would be inappropriate to say a certain thing to a certain person at a certain time, that kind of social perspective dimension. So I think how you say things, what you say, how you think about them or where those ideas came from in terms of logic, thinking, concept formation, and when you say them, and to whom you say them, are all important ways of broadening the understanding of thought disorder.
And I guess we need to remind our listeners that, you know, going back to the idea of continua, that it's a matter of degree, because some of the things that you're talking about in relationship to thought disorder might characterize very creative people.
Absolutely.
Or the last things that you were saying about the appropriateness of the situation and so on, you know, at a less extreme level could characterize somebody who's very rebellious or, again, kind of creative in their way of being.
Those are all critically important to when you have evidence like on a test, like the Rorschach, for example, of disordered thinking, a response, for example, that might be indicative of a disturbance in thought organization. It's important to have some sense of the context, the person's intent. Were they, as you mentioned a moment ago, being rebellious? Are they trying to shock? Are they wanting to flout reality, upset the examiner? Or could this be a highly creative person? I know if my friend Ali Khadidi hears this, he will roll his eyes because I frequently in our teaching use this, what I think is a wonderful set of examples about distinguishing creativity from disordered thinking. There's an old story about James Joyce bringing his daughter to see Carl Jung so many eons ago. James Joyce's daughter appeared to be suffering from some kind of mental disorder, which was later thought to be something like schizophrenia. And so Carl Jung, the eminent Swiss psychiatrist, examined her, and there's a famous story about Jung and Joyce taking a walk through the garden, and Carl Jung telling James Joyce that his daughter suffered from schizophrenia. He called it dementia praecox, but James Joyce said, "What does that mean?" And Carl Jung said, "Well, it's a disorder characterized by disturbance in thinking and a disturbance in speech, where words are invented and thoughts are illogical and combined in ways that don't make sense. and language is used in non-conventional ways that are very difficult to understand. And James Joyce said, well, this is how we write. She's a writer like I am. And Carl Jung is said to have responded, well, that's true, Mr. Joyce, but you come to the edge of the water and you dive to the depth. Your daughter, unfortunately, comes to the edge and falls in and loses herself. So he brought in this idea of intentionality.
Yeah, that's a good story. I've not heard it before. So a big challenge, it would seem, when it comes to this work would be differential diagnosis, because psychotic symptoms can overlap one another, and it's very rare for someone to be a classic case like we read in our textbook on psychopathology. In fact, I recall research from some years ago that suggested that clinicians diagnosing the same cases based on the same case histories often came up with very different diagnoses. So there's that whole issue of, I guess it's of reliability.
Sure.
Assessing that, you know, telling.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned case histories, and case history would certainly imply use of multi-method approach that would include historical information, the family history, clinical interviews, and psychological testing procedures.
So you're suggesting that having multiple modes of assessment will make it more likely that you'll hone in on, that different clinicians would hone in on the same assessment or diagnosis?
I think it certainly increases the likelihood.
Mm-hmm.
I know in my work, which consists of a lot of psychodiagnostic, a lot of testing-based work, that I often feel as though somebody once used this analogy in a different context, but I'm kind of working in the dark with a strobe light going off and on.
Huh.
And occasionally during those moments that the light is on, I feel through the methods that I employ that I see something very clearly. I catch a glimpse of it, and then the light is goes off. And then over time, I'm able to put together enough clarity to come up with some sort of a set of inferences about what's going on with somebody. I rarely make especially in talking about psychosis, and even more so when a young person is involved, I will rarely make a definitive diagnosis, certainly with a severe mental illness like schizophrenia. But what I will do is I'll talk about the individual's functioning and what aspects of their functioning seem to be compromised. And then what kinds of diagnostic possibilities might be consistent with that.
Mm-hmm.
But often this leads to recommendations for increased ongoing treatment, consultations for medication, and diagnostic sharpening over time. I think it's always a mistake to oversell our certainty about what diagnosis is most appropriate or what is not.
Yes.
Sometimes it's very clear, but more often in my work, I end up seeing people who very smart, skilled clinicians have already seen and are puzzled by. So I see people who there's more than one thing going on, and it's often not it takes some time to try to tease out the different components.
Yeah, that's a key point there, is that typically there are more than one thing going on, and people don't come in with sort of just one thing. or so it seems, in the clinical situation. You've mentioned clinical interviewing, and it seems like that might be one of your main tools for psychotic assessment in your own work. Do I have that right?
It is a necessary, but in my view, not sufficient approach. This is interesting. It's a little backstory. I think between my colleague, Dr. Khadevi, and I, one of the reasons our sort of professional relationship and friendship developed as it did is that we really each brought a unique perspective. Because of the setting in which he works, the clinical interview is the first line of assessment. You are conducting an interview, often in the emergency room.
Yep.
And in my work, clearly I would not begin testing somebody without a careful interview. But I employ a lot of testing. Khadevi does as well. But I think both of us put the accent, I think, in a slightly different place. I've learned a great deal from him about the nuances of the clinical interview. And by the way, clinical interviewing, I think, is, we make the point of the book, kind of a lost art. People take it for granted, or they might sort of use cookie-cutter kinds of structured interview checklists.
Like who's the current president, things like that.
Yeah.
Say a little bit more about how a more nuanced interview might go.
You base the whole concept on the fact that interviewing is a basic form of assessment. Observing, interviewing, i.e. talking to somebody, as well as doing testing. They're all forms of assessing. And the goal is to try to understand an individual's behavior, what underlies their behavior, what their internal world is like. In interviewing, we're striving for a collaborative process in which we are genuinely interested in understanding this other person's experience in a curious and respectful and empathic manner.
Yeah.
But based on a clear understanding of what the conditions and the symptoms are that we're interested in trying to understand. So I know that's a rather global kind of explanation, but it really is a starting point for kind of setting the stage for an attitude about how one goes about this. We don't want to interrogate a patient. We don't want to treat them as specimens. We're interested in the person who has the symptoms or the illness. And I think people like to, and one of the problems with psychosis assessment has always been the dehumanizing of people, the tendency to forget about the person and become enamored by a set of intriguing symptoms, like the Elephant Man, which I think is a story about a surgeon who gets captivated with an individual's physical deformity and actually finds him at a freak show and takes him on the roads. And I think that there's a danger in doing that with diagnostic work, mm-hmm. especially with psychosis. Yeah. And interviews can be that way, too, where we're just interested instead of assessing a set of symptoms and really not trying to understand what the person's experience of those symptoms are.
Yeah. It's not a main psychological tests. And early in the book, you kind of say we're not going to really focus on that a whole lot here. You're not going to try to teach people how to use them, but you do have a chapter on assessing psychotic dimensions with psychological tests. And when I was in graduate school, long, long time ago, we used tests such as the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale, that's the WACE, the Rorschach, which you've mentioned, the Binder Gestalt, the TAT, or Thematic Apperception Test, the MMPI, among others. And I remember also at that time, it was a more, I think, sort of neuropsychologically oriented battery called the Rytan. I haven't heard anything about that lately. So, but in your book, you actually allude to scads of tests that I didn't know existed, never heard of. Maybe you can take us a bit through some of the rationale behind psychological testing and any modern developments that we should know about.
Sure. Well, testing really, the reason that we didn't want to write a book about testing is that we wanted to reach a broader audience, and I felt that testing would immediately exclude a fairly broad range of mental health professionals. By the way, even psychologists.
That's funny because the early days of psychology, psychologists were the testers. That was their role. They weren't even therapists. That only came along later.
Which unfortunately alienated generations of psychologists. And it still does. You know, testing is not for everybody. It's very labor intensive.
Yeah.
There are different personalities who enter the field of psychology. Some like doing this kind of investigative work, and others don't.
Yes.
Dr. Khadidi and I did a workshop at a state psychological association. And the workshop that we had proposed was to do something on the Rorschach and the clinical interview and psychosis. And the feedback we got was from the committee was, that sounds so, so fascinating. However, many of our psychologists really aren't that familiar with the Rorschach. So could you make it broader and not talk about the Rorschach per se? And this really was kind of a springboard for our thinking about, you know, we want to reach a broader range of people and be able to talk about this in ways that people might appreciate who aren't just those familiar with the Rorschach.
Yeah, and just in case I have listeners out there who don't recognize the term, the Rorschach, it's the famous ink blot test where psychologists show a series of ink blots, which are presumably random random images, you know, created through, and then they ask the person being assessed to talk about what they see in there.
Yeah, what the instruction is very simple there. There are 10 ink blots. It's a test that was devised by Hermann Rorschach back in turn of the 20th century, the early couple of decades. And it's been a test that has endured a very long and a stormy history, collecting a international group of followers across the decades, including up to the present time, and then a group of naysayers and critics.
Yes.
But it's funny how it still exists as a formidable tool that has one of its greatest strengths in the assessment of disordered thinking and other kinds of psychotic symptoms. Not so much hallucinations and delusions. That's where the clinical interview is superior. But in terms of understanding how someone thinks and how they employ logic and reason, the Rorschach is a very effective method. And the other thing about the Rorschach is the volumes of empirical research that support its use up to the present time.
Interesting.
Very impressive research that supported its robust, the robustness of its use in assessing thought disorder.
That's fascinating to hear because I was in graduate school more than 40 years ago, I think. And so it's interesting to hear that that not only has it endured, but that research continues to be done on it.
You know, it's funny because it's our field as psychologists has mushroomed in terms of of the different areas of interest. And I know in graduate training, there are so many things that command the attention of faculty, things that, that they need to teach graduate students that testing and the Rorschach have gotten pushed aside. So it's not uncommon to see it being underemphasized in graduate training, but it is something that is still a mainstay of competent clinical psychological assessment.
Yeah, I was at the University of Michigan, which was a bastion of psychoanalytic thought, actually. And so it got a lot of attention in my experience. But I'm not at all surprised to hear that it's faded in other more contemporary training programs. Mm-hmm. Let's switch our focus a little bit in the time that we have left.
Sure.
Talk a bit about the risk of suicide in psychotic individuals and how you might go about assessing that.
Sure. Psychosis certainly is a risk in people struggling with psychosis. And I think that we want to keep in mind the basic kinds of demographic factors that define risk in any individual. Things like age and gender, race, recent kinds of loss and narcissistic injury, the presence of drug and alcohol abuse, and a history of past suicide attempts. The presence of a mental illness, the presence of depression. So all of those tried and true demographic factors that increase suicide risk should be thought about with individuals who suffer from psychosis. In addition to that, though, there are other things we want to pay attention to. One is has to do with insight into illness. And this is kind of paradoxical because generally we think of insight as a good thing. I mentioned early on that insight is kind of a linchpin in understanding psychosis. And insight really has to do with whether or not an individual can understand that the psychotic symptoms they might be having are a product of an illness.
Uh-huh.
For example, I mentioned early on that simply hallucinating is not a pathognomonic of psychosis. The issue is how somebody understands that, what their interpretation of it is, how much insight they have into their symptoms. So when it comes to psychosis, insight can be problematic. It can increase the risk. And again, it's paradoxical because insight is generally thought of as, in terms of a resource.
Fascinating.
It can lead a person to change. But depression is correlated with insight. But insight, especially when an individual is in a resolution stage of the psychosis and looks back and sees the stress and loss and trauma in their life as a result of a psychotic episode that might have involved hospitalization, loss of income, damaged relationships, as well as a shattered sense of self, that can be very demoralizing. In the book, we talk about a suicidal doctoral level patient who had a history of psychosis and was very in a great deal of agony as he described how he went from private practice to a private insane asylum. So this was somebody who had clear insight into the devastating effects of his psychosis, and that increased his suicide risk. Having active delusions, having a great deal of anxiety and agitation can be risk factors for suicide in somebody who has psychosis. Command hallucinations that are instructing an individual to take his own life are also certainly things that increase the risk.
Well, there's so much more that we could discuss, so much more in your book that we just don't have time to get to. But before we finish, one topic I didn't find in your book is the concept of the spiritual emergency. Are you familiar with that concept?
I am familiar with it, and I think it's a fascinating concept that I wish that we had somehow included, and I think we ran into constraints with our editors and had to eliminate things. It would have been a nice addition to the final section on the book, or the penultimate section on the book, where we talk about special issues.
Yeah.
It would have fit nicely into the either in the chapter or following the chapter on cultural perspective.
Right.
Because I think it does come kind of close to that, and there's a lot of, I think, overlap in thinking about psychotic phenomenon as a possible personal growth, from a personal growth perspective as opposed to a psychopathological perspective.
Yeah, and so it would present particular assessment issues to make a differential decision as to what's going on. So maybe that'll be in your next book.
Well, I mean, it also fits with what you brought up earlier, and that's creativity. When is something the product of a highly creative, kind of divergent mind, or when is it a sign of mental illness? When are symptoms a product of psychopathology? When are they a sign of a personal kind of growth? When are they culturally determined? When are they not? I mean, all of those things are important to think about, I think, as clinicians when we look at patients who present with some of these psychotic symptoms.
Well, I think that's a good wrap-up statement right there. So, Dr. Jim Kleiger, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, I want to thank you for this conversation. It felt like a conversation over a cup of coffee.
Yeah, right.
With an interested colleague. So it's been fun for me, and I do appreciate your hosting me and asking such good questions and giving me a chance to talk about this area.
I loved it when Dr. Kleiger pointed out that there are two kinds of psychologists, those who love diagnostic testing and those who don't. We had a bit of conversation after the interview, and somehow he picked up on the fact that I'm in the second category, those who don't. As he stated in the interview, he has a real passion for it. Passion is a strong word. I can see how a person with the right personality bent, it can have all the excitement and challenge of being a Sherlock Holmes sort of detective, a fascination with discovering all the little clues that ordinary mortals might miss, and from those clues being able to construct a full picture of their implications. There was a strong emphasis on psychological testing in my own doctoral education way back when. Believe it or not, my teachers and supervisors seemed to think I was quite good at it. However, my own secret suspicion was that I'm a good creative writer. I'm not sure how accurate my perceptions were, but I could weave a convincing story. That same skill has served me well in my work as a market research consultant. It's a similar process. I interview groups or individuals about products or services they use and take the various bits I glean and weave a compelling narrative. There are so many more psychological tests out there than when I was a wee shrink, and they are far more specific. For example, there are a number that are particularly aimed at teasing out the various elements of psychosis. Among those mentioned in the book by Dr. Kleiger and his co-author, Dr. Kadivi, are the Auditory Hallucination Rating Scale, the Altman Self-Rating Mania Scale, the Brown Assessment of Belief Scale, the Beck Cognitive Insight Scale, the Brief Negative Symptoms Scale, the Brief Psychiatric Rating Scale, the Bonn Scale for the Assessment of Basic Symptoms, the Characteristics of Auditory Hallucinations Questionnaire, the Characteristics of Delusions Rating Scale, the Calgary Depression Scale for Schizophrenia, the Diagnostic Interview Schedule for Children and Adolescents, the Delusions Symptoms State Inventory, the Positive and Negative Syndrome Scale, the Peters Delusional Inventory, the Prodromal Questionnaire, the Scale for the Assessment of Negative Symptoms, the Scale for the Assessment of Positive Symptoms, the Schizophrenia Cognition Rating Scale, the Simple Delusional Syndrome Scale, and so on. When I asked Dr. Kleiger to define psychosis, I didn't share the old joke that came to mind, which goes as follows. Neurotics build castles in the air. Psychotics live in those castles, and psychiatrists are the ones who charge the rent. So once again, the title of Dr. James Kleiger's book is Assessing Psychosis, A Clinician's Guide. If you'd like to order it and at the same time help to support Shrink Wrap Radio, please go to our site and click on the Amazon.com banner ad that you'll see in the right-hand sidebar.
I support Shrink Wrap Radio for Dr. Dave has his pulse on the emerging contemporary rising stars, endeavoring to provide soul food for listeners seeking nourishment. His recent interview with Dr. Emerson was the pivotal interview, for I have waited 65 years for the reality of trauma-bonded babies, the implications for development, and the due care and attention these special infant children, whom I call sensitives, of which I'm one, so deserve. As a recent contributor, I am listening deeply to the contributions you bring us all.
Thank you, Linda Thompson. I do hope some more of you will join Linda in supporting our work here. We do have one new donor since the last episode whose name has been added to the honor roll, and he is Zachary Sandler. So thank you very much, Zachary. By the way, let me call your attention to one of our sponsors in the right-hand sidebar. You'll see an ad for Unflame, an herbal pain remedy designed by Dr. Robert Hedaya. And you might recall he's the founder of Whole Psychiatry, whom I interviewed most recently on Shrink Wrap Radio number 460. Not only is he a psychiatrist, but he's also trained in psychopharmacology. He developed this herbal blend to deal with his own back pain and was amazed to see how effective it was, and so he decided to make it available to all. And I have to tell you, I am a satisfied and ongoing customer myself. So you'll find an ad for it in the right-hand sidebar on our site, and you can use the discount code UNFL1815 there. So check it out. And once again, let me remind you to go to the survey tab on our site to take the updated survey. And I want to thank all of you who have ordered our new app. As I've said before, I'm hearing great reports on it. The downside of the app, I realized, however, is that it eliminates the need for you to go to our website, which is where you need to go in order to make donations and order books by our guests or take advantage of any of our other affiliate offers. However, I have discovered that it is possible for you to get to the various features on our website using the app. In the upper right-hand corner, when you're in the app, you'll see the outline of a head. Click on that and you'll see a whole list of actions, one of which is visit the website. Aha! It can't show you the whole website on a tiny phone screen, but you'll be able to navigate around with just a little effort. So you should be able to make a donation, and also to see the affiliate ads that I announce in the right-hand and left-hand sidebars. Go ahead and give it a try. And if you do, let me know how it turned out for you. I'd love to hear from you about that. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, my recommendation today is the audiobook Girl with Curious Hair, Stories. It's unabridged, and it's by David Foster Wallace. And it's about 14 hours of goodness. And I'm passing this recommendation along as a result of my adult son, Matthew, recommending it to me while visiting from Manhattan over the recent Labor Day weekend. I gather that David Foster Wallace was something of a phenom for my son's generation. I only discovered him as a result of the recent film, The End of the Tour, starring Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg. I highly recommend the film if you haven't seen it. By the way, Audible.com has a number of his books beyond this collection in Girl with Curious Hair. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, there are more than 180,000 other titles there for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. You're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Fernando Blanco. I hope everything is going well for you there in Mexico City. Hey folks, I could use some more of these transitions. How about sending me a brief audio file along the lines of, this is so-and-so in such-and-such a place, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. I'll read just one recent email from our listener community today. This one is from Bill, who writes to report a problem with my audio. He writes, Hi, I've been enjoying your podcast, so thanks for the good work. However, I'm wondering if the audio quality of the host's voice, I think that would be me, can be improved. It's odd because the recording quality of the guest's voice usually sounds very good, while the host's voice sounds like a low-fidelity compressed stream. It's tinny and garbled, especially in the higher frequencies. One would think that the host's voice would sound very clear and natural since the host is at the source with a good microphone. Actually, there were some episodes where I had accidentally not used the good microphone and it was using the computer's microphone built in, so that might be what caused the problem. Back to the letter. He goes on to say, I access the podcast using BeyondPod, and it could be that whatever stream they tap into is overly compressed bitwise. Too much compression can create the garbled noises and artifacts that I hear at the higher frequencies on the host's voice. It could just be that the EQ needs to be adjusted on the host's voice, maybe adding some low and mid-range to it so that the compressed stream sounds better. It sounds like the EQ is just right on the guests' voices so that their compressed stream is much clearer. It gets a little tiring to listen to, but the content is great, so maybe a few EQ tweaks can help. Also, make sure you are recording the master audio for the host's voice at a high bitrate before publishing the compressed version, but I'm sure you're doing that. Thanks, and that's from Bill. And Bill, thanks for calling this to my attention, and it might be, as I noted earlier, that we were listening to the wrong mics, and that tended to make it kind of echoey. And then I discovered that a few episodes ago and have corrected it. You know, after 10 years of doing this, you'd think I have it totally down by now, but I still run into problems occasionally. And right now, I think my sound is pretty good. If it's still sounding bad, I have to say I suspect that the BeyondPod app you are using is the culprit. Meanwhile, those others of you who are listening now, if you're having similar issues, please do let me know. I've not heard any other spontaneous complaints, but do let me know of any issues that I should be made aware of. So with that, I'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail using the app that I mentioned, which you'll find on the apps tab on our site. Or you can use our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. James Kleiger, for sharing his work on the assessment of psychosis. My next interview will be with Machiel Klerk, my strategic partner who runs the site, the Jung Platform, and he'll be sharing his work on Rumi and the World of Dream. I think all you dreamers and poets are going to love this one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.